I didn't make it easy for Vienna to become my favorite city.
In autumn of 1972, 3 months after high school graduation, I packed my bags in Salzburg, went to the train station and headed for the capital.
My plan was to enroll either in medicine or theater studies or something else entirely. An interest in too many things at once has always been my talent and shortcoming. I was the youngest of 4 sons of a couple who had stranded in Austria in 1945 and held an inaptitude for practical matters and a certain unworldliness in high esteem. And so, when I arrived in Vienna, careless as I had started out, I suddenly felt lost. I suppose I was surprised that no one awaited me at Westbahnhof station to show me the city and enlighten me about where to get information about the studies I was pondering and how to possibly inscribe. I had heard the designated catchwords, matriculation and enrollment, but found such procedures a bureaucratic nuisance which preferably I would only face in the last possible moment. There were no mobile phones at the time and no relatives or friends in the city to turn to. So I moved on from the train station toward the inner city, read the street names and thought, see, Maria-Hilfer-Straße, it's famous, I'm on the right track.
At some point, I came to stand before the youth hostel, where I found shelter and a basis to roam the vicinity for 3 days,
aimless and increasingly perplexed. The city didn't seem beautiful, rather unwelcoming. The rows of houses were gray and shabby. The magnificent buildings like fortifications erected to intimidate me personally. I don't think that I, craving support, ever looked upwards to the other archive of the city, with its sculptures and statuettes, goddesses and angels, perched on their roofs overlooking or looking down upon the mere mortals. Be that as it may, I walked back and forth between the 2 horsemen on Heldenplatz Square, who I identified as Archduke Karl and Prince Eugene of Savoy, and got the impression that the steeds of these 2 triumphant field marshals were frozen in their leap just before thundering towards one another. Disappointed that Vienna was clearly not willing to take any notice of me, I went back home and began, quite unoriginally, to study German and history. 14 years later, I published my first book, a passionate homage to Vienna's most bitter poet, the expressive Albert Ehrenstein, a master in defying his despair with venomous verses. In one of his essays that I dug out for my book, Wann endet die Nacht? When does night end? He sarcastically maintained, with all the equestrian statues of the powerful and mighty in mind, that their spiritual substance did not reside in the heroes and their myth, nor in the horses, but in the pedestals, which you could place a different horseman on every 2 weeks and create a traveling monument culture of sorts. Although I was already convinced back then that the true history of a city is chronicled in its literature, it was not enough for me on the longer term to explore Vienna in books and libraries alone. For in and with the pertinent literature grew my desire for the city itself. So it was only convenient that my girlfriend entertained a fascination for Vienna too, and flushed me out of my reading routine in a quaint pied-à-terre in the cellar of a derelict little castle on the outskirts of Salzburg.
In this manner of seduction and guidance, I would discover the Vienna of the great museums.
The coordinates I oriented upon were drawn between the Natural History Museum and the Kunsthistorisches Museum, the Secession, Belvedere and Albertina,
the so-called Zwanzigerhaus of 20th century art, and the Museum of Science and Technology, which consoled me with a first sense of security
while moving through a city whose greater structure was otherwise still uncharted territory. Sure enough, upon arrival in Vienna, we'd soon end up on the square between the Museum of Natural History and Art History, where Empress Maria Theresa sat throned so dignified in full command of her power and corpulence atop her monument that I found something almost disrespectful about it. And even higher up, there on the edges of the buildings were statues who seemed to converse across the square, and you must know who they represented, the most important scientists and thinkers of their time. Soon, by happy coincidence, we would no longer travel to Vienna on our own, but in the company of our small children. Another way to learn how to see a city. Never before had I noticed that the Herakles on Michaela Tor depicted a madman baring his teeth full of wrath and hate, until I stood before him holding my son's hand and he recognized the petrified grimaces, the naked muscleless brawn, as those fellas who accompanied him everywhere he went. The hard plastic Ninja Turtles or the legendary He-Man, a ludicrous power figure from the global toy industry. And then there is my daughter, all the things I discovered with her in the Prater or the park in front of the Votiv Church, nearby her first apartment in Vienna,
which she moved into after 15 years had passed by so heartrendingly quick.
Because when after school and a year in Africa, she had a look around the city, she did so to actually study there and to stay. In the meanwhile, I had traveled to many regions on the fringes of our continent and published a couple of books in which I tell of those Europeans living on the borderlines, the small nationalities and smallest linguistic groups, and about me, always setting off from home with the confidence to encounter myself in the foreign too. I didn't really realize how swiftly I would be identified with my travel reports. But when I had my 50th birthday, an article was published in a major German newspaper in which I was proclaimed the European traveler par excellence. I remember finding this par excellence a bit peculiar, but all the more so that it only took a mere decade for the virtue of a couch potato, a bookworm, to become a supposed traveling venturer. Me, who always considered the restless adventurer running away from himself a particularly boring type of person. I had visited and described many cities in the dusty provinces of Europe and usually stayed in areas still untouched by the type of tourism with the alleged beauties of Europe all included in its program. Not for nothing, the other motto I dubbed my travels and travel literature reads, On the Beauty of Ugly Cities and Areas, Regions, Districts, Villages. Nevertheless, I found it arrogant, if not downright embarrassing, that it was easier for me to get my bearings in some of these cities than in Vienna. That is why I made the belated decision to walk Vienna in my way, and with such tenacity until it would become my favorite city on the planet. My Viennese friends typically just know their way around their neighborhood and in the first district. When they have to leave their flat for another part of the city, they prefer to take the subway, which has many advantages, but also the disadvantage that you do not perceive the route traveled with open eyes. What is being built and demolished, how the face of the city is changing, becoming older and younger at the same time, this remains hidden from those who travel underground. My wife and I, by contrast, are almost always walking, so we can always tell our clueless friends, with a mild dose of vanity, things they had no idea about in their hometown and our favorite city. Naturally, you cannot discover everything on your own and just for yourself. Whoever had set eyes on the photography of Christine de Concy, in which she brings the stone Vienna to life and makes monuments and sculptures speak of their desolation, but also the people passing by at their feet, will not discover a completely different Vienna, rather memorable new facets to complement the image one has formed of the city. This is owed to the fact that de Concy boldly ventured up on the roofs of the city so we can see the sculptures high above for the first time up close, and the fact that she makes the monuments down there visible in a new way from the perspective up above. This in itself has sufficient aesthetic appeal and indeed an enlightening quality. But it wouldn't mean nothing if the photographer up above didn't sympathize with the people down below. When Christine de Grancy sees and shows us the city from the heights, her aim is not a repellent distance. Rather, her Vienna from above merges effortlessly with the Vienna down below.